welcome to our Campus FM listeners. This is a new series entitled Back in Time. In the next 13 episodes, we shall be discussing broad themes associated with the study of archaeology and trying to understand why these various areas of study are really significant in the exploration of the archaeological past. Before I introduce today's guest, I'd like to mention that this program is being recorded on Zoom. So if you do hear a few noises off, you'll know why. Helping us in this exploration today is Dr. Maxine Anastasi. She's senior lecturer in the Department of Classics and Archaeology, Faculty of Arts at the University of Malta. And she'll be talking to us about the importance of pottery in the field of archaeology. Thank you, Dr. Anastasi, for accepting to come on the program. I have to say that I'm almost embarrassed to ask you to talk about pottery in archaeology in barely 30 minutes. But I feel sure that within that time frame, you can give us at least some idea of what pottery means to archaeology. To give maximum time to the subject at hand, I won't be providing long bios of my guests, myself. University staff members all have their bios online for those who might be interested in following up. But perhaps in a few words, Maxine, if I may, Maxine, you could tell us where your love of pottery comes from and where your studies led you.
Thank you very much, Tricia, for inviting me to speak on this program. Well, with regards to sort of falling in love with pottery, it sort of happened a little bit slowly, really after my undergraduate. I've always loved archaeology and then read for an undergraduate in archaeology at the University of Malta. And there was never any doubt in my mind that I'd like to continue for a master's degree. And so I carried out a research master's, and I was given the opportunity to work on a project on a sort of with material that I can't say I knew much about before I began, and thought, let's just have a go. Not many people had been familiar with Roman pottery at that time. And almost immediately, I think just handling all of this material was incredibly exciting. And it's always a sort of detective work in trying to find out as much as you can about these fragments of really rubbish that people used to throw away in the past. Ultimately, that's what pottery is. And from there, I used to just write to people, ask them whether I could join them whilst they're working on pottery, try and go to as many conferences as I could. And I met some fantastic people on the way who really, really helped me. Managed to travel around the Mediterranean, really, following people and learning from them and handling the material. So it was a lot of reading, but also a lot of handling and actually experiencing how one looks at the material and is able to take information from it. And really, that's how it is. And the more I think I learned about it, and the more I could sort of piece together this big jigsaw puzzle, the more I just fell in love with it. And now it sort of takes a lot of time to just talk about it and shut me up half the time, because I just love talking about them.
No, I won't shut you up, but I should encourage you to tell us more. Perhaps as an initial step, you could try to define pottery, because we say pottery, we talk about ceramics, we talk about non-wheel-made, you know, pottery as a definition, please, if you can.
Sure, of course. Ultimately, we, in the archaeology fields, define pottery as really any vessel or receptacle or container that is made of clay that's been fired. So the sort of crucial point of this is that the clay itself has to undergo a process where it is fired and hardened to a material that cannot be sort of reversed back into its natural sort of raw material, and that will be clay ultimately. And we sort of use we differentiate between ceramics and pottery really in the shape of the material. So ceramics can sort of include many other items and artifacts that are made of fired clay but don't necessarily form containers or vessels. So when we talk of pottery, We are really looking at the plates, bowls, the storage jars, which were made of this fired clay. Ceramics then can include building materials like ceramic tiles, as well as figurines, and all sorts of other different shapes and objects made of clay, but that are not necessarily related to plates and bowls and storage containers. Ultimately, anything related to food production, that's really what we really focus on. Containers for eating and drinking, preparing food, cooking food, as well as storing food and using these containers to transport food across different shores.
Yes, the archaeologists, especially prehistory, but not necessarily just prehistory, when they find pottery on a site, they get terribly excited. So what is it about finding sherds or pots, if we're lucky, or bits of pots that can be put together, as you say, in a little bit of a jigsaw? Why is it that they love to find pottery on an archaeological site?
Yeah, I will confess that I'm one of those people that gets very, very excited depending on the fragments that we find. Ultimately, as archaeologists, especially those who are working in the field, our main data set, sort of the information that we have in order to understand people in the past and what they were doing, is mainly through all the rubbish that was left from the activities that they carried out. And so when we excavate an archaeological site, we are interested in this material, these material artifacts, these objects that survive. If we think of the prehistoric period, for instance, that's a time before writing had been invented, so we don't have that body of information or evidence to inform us about what people were doing in the past. And even in historical periods, writing and the survival of texts only really helps us for a certain sort of part of the story. Many of the people who lived in the ancient world were either illiterate or did not have access to the education to allow them to write. And so many activities, particularly those to do with sort of the poorer people, don't come through in the ancient texts. So as archaeologists, we are really interested in what they threw away. And out of that material, what actually then survives the hundreds or thousands of years for us archaeologists to find. And for this, ultimately, when an archaeologist does come across a whole load of pottery fragments or sherds, as we call them, the waste itself, and this is all waste, is fundamental for giving us all sorts of information about the date of the activities that were carried out, which in turn help us date the site and the different phases of a particular building or sanctuary, for that matter. And it's also, pottery also holds a sort of a special place in this sort of network of different types of evidence, because it's so plentiful at many, many sites. And the reason it is plentiful is because it was very cheap to produce a widely available resource, sort of clay, in order to fire. And the sort of the, even though it's a very sort of hard material once it's fired, the problem is, and everyone knows, that if they drop a ceramic plate on the floor, the likelihood is it's going to smash into many, many pieces. And so because it was cheap, because sort of it was easily breakable, there was a much higher turnover of people manufacturing and also obtaining different vessels. And being cheap as well, it wasn't the end of the world if something happened to this vessel, and the material itself could very rarely be recycled into something else. So it wasn't like a metal, sort of a bronze or a metal object, which could easily be recycled, melted down and recycled. And so,
interesting point that actually, you're right. Of course, it is something that couldn't be recycled. If we can go into a little bit of detail about what constitutes the clay mix, because there are so many different types of it's not just clay very often, and sometimes there's even organic stuff actually in the clay mix. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. The raw material itself would be easily sort of mined or quarried, really, from available either clay beds or even sort of very clay-rich soils. And we find that quite commonly around Malta, particularly the north, even around Rabat and Dindina. And yes, this material did need to be purified in order to sort of separate it from the bits of stone and grasses that would have been caught up in this material. However, raw clay itself, the pure clay, does require some other material to be added so that it retains its sort of strength when a vessel is shaped and molded. And it tends to happen that potters would have used resources that were close at hand. And this is why we end up with a lot of clays which were mixed with different bits of crushed limestone or quartz or shell, as well as organic material, in order to give it extra malleability and structure. And for archaeologists as well, this is a treasure trove of information, because the different rocks and minerals that are crushed and added to this clay help us as archaeologists be able to identify and trace possible locations of manufacture. And so sourcing these raw materials from the neighbouring areas or within the vicinity of these workshops allows us to be able to determine whether pottery vessels were exported overseas. And for the classical periods, particularly the Greek, the Roman period, this type of information is incredibly important for reconstructing ancient trade routes. We know pots themselves didn't have legs to sort of run around in, so whatever pot is transported across the sea had to have happened, you had to have got there because of human intervention. And we find all sorts of material in Malta, for instance. We have wine amphora, which were sort of, we were importing wine from Italy and North Africa, together with olive oil from North Africa and Spain. And so all of these containers were moving around, and we are able to identify that from these little bits of fragments found in the clay itself. We can determine what's from South Italy, primarily because it's got a lot of volcanic material, which is not present in Malta, or else from North Africa, which has a lot of sort of desert sand and desert quartz in the material that, again, we don't find in abundance here.
So that's, it's sort of, the pottery is talking to us.
Exactly, yeah.
Really from a long time ago. About the production of the pottery, I know that it's rare to find kilns, especially in prehistory. I'm always amazed how they actually managed to create the heat to actually fire these clays. Do we have evidence of how they managed to do that?
Locally, not as much. But if we're looking at the Roman period, which is something that I tend to specialise in, there is ample evidence of kilns being excavated and identified. And really and truly, pottery doesn't need sort of such high temperatures, that the ease of achieving these temperatures, you probably need a minimum of about 550 to 650 degrees Celsius in order to fire a pot to a degree that it is relatively durable and survives in the archaeological record. And this could really be achieved by using any source of fuel, particularly sort of wood or animal dung, even the trimmings of olive trees and sort of pruning have all been found to contain quite high energy or be high energy fuel sources that have allowed people to fire kilns. And it's also the structure of kilns. You can have very basic ones, which are just pits in the ground, and you sort of place your pots in the middle of this and then build fuel on top of it. Or else, sort of a little bit later, proper built structures were developed, and even the rudimentary ones would have sufficiently allowed heat to sort of be concentrated by this fuel and feed a chamber in the top part, sort of separating the pots from the actual fuel, and achieve this. It's obviously a very specialized process, and we sort of need to move away from this idea that sort of anyone in antiquity could easily just make pots with minimal knowledge. It's sort of a process which is passed on through the generations. And for very skilled potters, especially sort of the lovely red slit Roman dinner sets which were produced, those were very, very high tech, very specialized industries with very sophisticated kilns being produced. Yeah. And manufactured.
It's always a source of fascination to me that experts such as yourself can look at a piece of pottery and be able to recognize its date and where it comes from. What are the first things you look for if you're trying to determine provenance and age and date?
So, I mean, before I sort of launch into it, it is something that has taken, I suppose, now pushing on 15 years, as much as I'd hate to admit it, in sort of just experience in handling all of this material. No pottery specialist will ever know everything either. It's a case of sort of building on the accumulation of knowledge that already exists. I've amassed at least a decent collection of pottery catalogues, which archaeologists over the last sort of 50 to 100 years have catalogued pottery, drawn it, described it, and also relayed it in relation to the site that it's from. And so all of this information allows us as archaeologists to compare these fragments that we find in a new archaeological site with fragments that have come before us and that have been recorded at other sites. And when, let's say, I'm on a site and I get incredibly excited when a nice sort of assemblage of material has been identified, what we look for really is the shape of the pot. And the best type of fragments to give us this information, because ultimately not all pottery fragments are as informative, is a fragment which has a good profile. So it retains enough of the rim or the base or the shape of the vessel that can inform us about what it once was. And also this profile allows us to be able to compare it. So looking up through, going through the literature, browsing, compare it with other existing fragments, which we might not know about, but someone else has recorded at other sites. And besides the shape, it's also the sort of the decoration, the surface texture, the fabric, so the actual fired clay itself. I know I'm sort of notorious for always wanting to sort of break off a tiny, tiny little chip on pot fragments, not because sort of I want to damage it, but looking at the fabric and the fired clay material is incredibly informative for telling us where this potsherd might have been produced. So I want to look at and see all these different inclusions and see whether they are volcanic material, whether they're quartz, whether they're sort of different types of micas, which we know come primarily from South Italy, the East. And we can all use this information, the shape and the fabric, to build sort of a profile of each of these fragments. And the other element is that I've now sort of managed to obtain enough experience where the more common fragments are easily identifiable to me, identifying what the amphorae fragments are. An amphora, all most of the time, tend to be imported to particular places. And sort of it just builds up. So every site, you start with knowing very little about what's available, but the more that accumulates, then we're able to see, okay, we've got the majority of these fragments all date to a similar period because the forms match, the surface treatments match, the origins match. And then that builds this idea of it's Roman, it's probably late Republican in date. How many other sites that are Republican in date, have similar pottery profiles, and we build it on those ideas.
What about technology? Now, nowadays, there's obviously, you've talked about your personal experience and how that can inform your decision about provenance and age. But what are the technologies perhaps that have been developed more recently? How can they help you?
Oh, so the scientific world is just continuously sort of developing, and archaeologists are always happy to try them out and apply them to archaeological artifacts. And probably one of the sort of most informative, and that's been incredibly helpful for understanding the provenance of pottery fragments, has really been the characterization of the different geological components within the clay. I don't do it necessarily myself, but I'm involved with a lot of people. I've got students working on it, colleagues who do this fantastic work of ultimately cutting very, very, very thin slices of the ceramic profile and looking at them under optical light microscope in order to sort of identify what different rocks and geological components are present within the clay itself. And as I had mentioned earlier, each of these different components do match up to specific regions where they are present within the geology. And this has been really exciting recently for trying to characterize pottery that we strongly suspect is made in the Maltese Islands. And so slowly we are building, together with a collaboration of many, many people and many experts, the sort of a profile of what Maltese ceramics contain within them. And this is useful not only for us to be able to sort of confirm that specific types of pots were made in the location, and in this case it's Malta, but it's also really informative for putting this information out there internationally so that any pottery experts who are excavating sites in North Africa and Sicily and Italy have the information at hand to be able to recognize any potential fragments that might be Maltese. And when sort of a pottery expert in Sicily, for instance, locates or identifies Maltese pottery, that is an indication that that pottery has traveled there, usually by ship, as an export. And that's a very exciting then launch onto many different other questions that archaeologists enjoy exploring.
In the last literally few minutes, I'm sorry to say, that we have at our disposal, could you just mention perhaps a few of the cultural insights that somebody like yourself can take from what they find, especially useful, I suppose, are grave goods, which are the most likely the ones to be a little bit a little bit whole.
Yes, so grave goods, depending on the different area, obviously, but again, sort of local to us and the central Mediterranean, pottery, whole pottery objects were used as grave offerings. And placed in the tomb with the deceased and sealed up for all eternity, or at least most of the time all eternity, until us archaeologists come along and open them. And with tombs and funerary archaeology, we tend to find whole objects more often than not, because they tend to be sealed off and they are sort of, they go out of circulation. They're not in the circulation of the living, where they've sort of got more chance of being broken or damaged. And although it's very difficult to sort of understand exactly what these vessels were placed in these tombs for, what we can start to infer is the shapes of the vessels tend to mostly follow a specific group that is constantly reoccurs in these different tombs. Like we always have presence of amphora. A lot of cups and jugs are always present within these tombs, and there's a strong link even that what we read through the Greek, through Greek literature, but also iconographic representations in Greek figure painting, is that these shapes are always associated with drinking, the drinking of wine. It was a very social activity carried out by the ancient Greeks. And this tradition has also was also followed by the ancient Phoenicians and many other cultures in the central Mediterranean. So it's not surprising that this sort of association with drinking wine is also passed on and is represented in ultimately a dead person's final send-off into the afterworld.
So they could go on enjoying what they had enjoyed.
Indeed.
On their time in earth, in their time in earth. Unfortunately, you know, we could go on all morning about the cultural aspect alone. But unfortunately, our time is coming to an end. I'd like to thank you very much, Dr. Maxine Anastasi, for being with us today and telling us something about the importance of pottery in archaeology. I hope it stimulated the interests of our listeners. The series is going to look at various themes that surround the discipline of archaeology, a field of study which helps us, as we've seen, to know and understand the past and also understand ourselves. Perhaps we shall be hearing from several experts in the field over the coming weeks, and I look forward to welcoming you all to Back in Time. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.